Welcome to today's critique, focusing on St. Kitts and Nevis as a life-coherent island commonwealth, which is a diagnostic framework proposing to re-nest the Federation's abstract economic indicators into foundational life support systems like water, food, energy, and youth.
Right. And diving straight into completeness and focus, the framework's fiscal transition strategy leaves a critical vulnerability unaddressed by leaning heavily on a volatile revenue stream to fund long-term structural changes.
Yeah, you're talking about the citizenship by investment revenues, right? The CBI?
Exactly. I mean, the text is actually highly self-aware about the broader dangers of economic dependency. It correctly identifies CBI as an abstract, volatile inflow.
Because the nation essentially sells passports or citizenship rights for capital.
Right, which is lucrative, but, you know, highly unpredictable. It's totally susceptible to shifting geopolitical winds or international visa regulations.
Okay, but if the author acknowledges that, what's the weakness in the framework?
The weakness is that mechanically, the Sovereign Wealth and Resilience Fund, which acts as the primary engine for this whole transition, is anchored directly to converting those exact CBI windfalls into durable assets.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, the text does not sufficiently detail a fallback mechanism if these funds evaporate entirely. It leaves the funding for this massive 10-year roadmap precariously exposed.
So if the primary fuel for the transition suddenly vanishes in, like, year two, the entire seven mission structure risks a complete stall.
Exactly.
I mean, isn't treating CBI as intergenerational patrimony essentially treating it like an unexpected inheritance?
That is a great way to put it.
Right. Because you don't build the foundation of your house relying on an inheritance you might not get. You might use those funds for the upgrades, like solar panels or a resilient roof.
Yeah, exactly.
But if you rely on it for the concrete foundation and the check doesn't clear, you just have a hole in the ground. So why does the roadmap currently feel so reliant on this windfall, despite the author's warnings against doing exactly that?
Well, it comes down to the sheer scale of the capital requirements, especially in the first 1 to 3 years. I mean, the roadmap demands massive structural shifts.
Right, like solarizing public buildings and overhauling the national water grid.
Yeah, and launching that Green-Blue Youth Corps. Those require an immense upfront injection of liquidity. The document funnels CBI into the fund because right now it's just the largest available pool of capital.
But by assigning the heaviest lifting to the most volatile revenue stream, they're building a dependency on the very mechanism they're trying to escape.
Exactly. So the suggestion here is to bolster the transition plan by stress testing the fiscal roadmap against extreme revenue shortfalls. That proves the framework's actual resilience.
Okay, so what's a concrete example of how they do that in the text?
The author should include a strict zero CBI transition model directly in the 100-day and 1-year roadmap.
Wait, a zero CBI model? Like showing what happens if it drops to zero tomorrow?
Yes, exactly. Demonstrate exactly how the seven missions could still be financed purely through reprioritized existing budgets, public sector utility savings, and newly proposed regenerative tourism restoration levies.
Okay, let's trace the mechanics of that. Because the framework promises utility savings through an EV fleet transition and solarizing public buildings.
Right.
How does a zero CBI model capture that practically?
Well, rather than just citing savings as some abstract future benefit, the author has to map out the accounting mechanism.
Show the math.
Show the math. Right. Detail how the moment a ministry's energy bill drops because of a new solar array, that specific monetary delta in the budget is instantly ring-fenced.
Oh, so it doesn't just get absorbed back into general government spending.
Exactly. It needs to be automatically diverted to fund, say, the Water First Federation mission. The savings from one upgrade directly finance the capital expenditure of the next.
That makes total sense. And the framework also proposes those regenerative tourism restoration levies. A zero CBI model would need to map the revenue generation of those specific levies, right?
Yeah. If a localized micro levy is applied to a baseline number of cruise ship arrivals, how does that substitute for a missing CBI windfall? Prove that a baseline flow of localized tourism revenue combined with those internal savings is enough to keep the transition moving.
Even if the international passport market collapses.
Exactly.
Well, that actually introduces another big issue, audience alignment and tone. Because the conceptual brilliance of the misnesting diagnosis risks being obscured by dense,
academic terminology that could alienate the exact policymakers required to rally behind it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the intellectual architecture of this piece is profound. But the weakness is that terms like epistemic shift, circular island metabolism, and social reproduction, they're intellectually rigorous, but they lack everyday political punch.
Right, you can't exactly walk into a community council or a farmer's meeting and start talking about epistemic shifts.
No, exactly. It alienates the Nevis Island administration and the local cooperatives. The academic tone occasionally distances the reader from the urgent physical reality of the island's challenges.
It honestly feels like reading the intricate engineering blueprint of an engine, when the local stakeholders, the people actually driving the transition, just need to know how the car drives.
That's a perfect analogy.
But let me push back a little here. Doesn't a white paper like this kind of need this level of academic rigor to be taken seriously?
How do you mean?
Well, if you're pitching to international donors, or the IMF, or the Green Climate Fund, don't they demand terms like macro abstractions and epistemic shift before they open their checkbooks?
They do, yes. International financial institutions absolutely operate in the language of macro abstractions, and maintaining credibility with them is necessary.
Right. But the risk here is that focusing solely on that institutional credibility completely overlooks the local buy-in you need to actually execute the transition on the ground.
Ah, I see.
Like the Green Climate Fund might approve a grant for a circular island metabolism. But a local fisherman facing declining yields needs to understand the physical mechanism of how this restores his livelihood.
Yeah, a district representative needs to be able to explain this to her constituents at a town hall.
Exactly. The mechanism of persuasion is completely different for these two audiences, and currently the document only speaks to one. So the suggestion is to anchor the abstract vocabulary with high-contrast, micro-level narratives that translate these macro concepts into immediate lived experiences.
Okay, so give us a concrete example of how the author can build that translation mechanism directly into the text.
Sure. So when explaining the transition from abstract system indicators, like GDP, to life ground indicators, juxtapose a specific celebrated economic win with an unmeasured local loss.
Oh, contrast them directly.
Yeah, don't just assert that the nation needs to measure retained life value. Tell a cause and effect story.
Okay, for instance, contrasting a celebrated 10% rise in cruise ship arrivals, which is, you know, the exact kind of abstract win politicians applaud in press conferences.
Right. Contrast that 10% rise directly with the immediate spike in marine litter in the harbor.
Wow, yeah.
Or place it next to the sudden increase in water rationing days for a household in Basseterre because the water grid is being diverted to service the port.
Or the massive spike in local food imports needed just to feed those temporary arrivals, which undercuts local agricultural demand.
Yes, exactly. By placing the abstract percentage right beside the physical daily reality of a dry water tap in a local household, the concept of misnesting instantly becomes a relatable, urgent political issue.
Yeah, you can literally see the cruise ship blocking the horizon while the local tap runs dry. It forces the reader, whether they are an IMF auditor or a local council member, to confront the direct causality of the current economic model.
It makes the invisible visible. And once that causality is made visible, the next challenge is how the government actually organizes itself to fix it.
Which brings us perfectly to structure and flow. Because the structural placement of life capital budgeting as just one of seven parallel missions misrepresents its actual role as the foundational prerequisite for the entire framework.
Right. Structure dictates execution in policy documents. And the weakness here is that visually and sequentially, the document lists life capital budgeting and sovereign resilience as Mission 7.
Sitting right alongside Mission 1, water, Mission 2, food, and the rest.
Exactly. Sitting right in a horizontal row with energy, youth, waste, and tourism. Organizing it this way implies that financial reform is simply a separate parallel track of work.
Which implies a minister could theoretically choose to prioritize, say, the Water First Federation mission and completely ignore Mission 7, like they're isolated initiatives.
Yes, but mechanically speaking, that's physically impossible. The other six missions cannot function, scale, or even launch without the public finance steering system, the life capital test, and the dashboard driving them.
Because government ministries operate in silos?
Right. If the federal budget process doesn't fundamentally prioritize life capital at the Treasury level, you cannot have a water-first federation. You'll just have an unfunded mandate.
So the suggestion is to reorganize the framework's hierarchy to clearly separate the foundational governance operating system from the targeted sectoral applications.
Yes.
But wait, let me challenge that structural shift. If we elevate finance, budgeting, and ledgers to the foundational top layer of the paper, doesn't that risk inadvertently re-nesting the entire concept back into the abstract economy mindset that the author is actively trying to dismantle?
That is the central philosophical tension of this entire transition.
Right. If we put the money at the very top of the visual hierarchy, aren't we just repeating the mistake of making finance the master rather than the servant?
If it's framed simply as balancing the budget, yes, absolutely. It looks like we are bowing to the dollar again. But we have to distinguish between finance as a societal goal and finance as a mechanism of governance.
Okay, explain that.
As the author notes elsewhere, a national budget isn't just a collection of funds. It's the central steering system of the state. It's the operating system. If you want the applications like the water grid, the food supply chain, the youth corps to run totally different programs, you have to rewrite the underlying operating system first.
Oh, I get it. If Mission 7 remains at the tail end of a list, it reads like an administrative afterthought assigned to the accounting department.
Exactly, rather than the strict prerequisite for any ecological change.
Okay, so concrete examples of how to fix this structure?
Visually and structurally, the author should group the National Life Coherence Dashboard and Life Capital Budgeting as the core operating system, or Layer 1. This foundational layer has to be detailed before the text even introduces the specific sectoral missions.
And then present the remaining six missions, water, youth, tourism, and so on, as the applications, or Layer 2, that are actively powered by that core system.
Right. The text should explicitly state this relationship, write clearly, before we can fix the water grid, we must rewire the mechanism that funds it.
It alters the reader's cognitive map of the document.
Exactly. You don't interact with a computer's operating system directly most of the time. You interact with the applications. But if the OS is broken, the applications crash.
The same applies to national governance.
Precisely.
Well, this has been incredibly insightful. To recap, this critique highlighted three key opportunities to strengthen the material. First, stress testing the fiscal model against a zero CBI scenario.
Right, making sure the framework isn't totally dependent on volatile passport funds.
Second, grounding academic terminology like misnesting with visceral local narratives.
Yes, swapping out some of the jargon for cause and effect examples, like the cruise ship arrivals versus the Basseterre water ration.
And third, structurally elevating life capital budgeting from a parallel mission to the overarching foundational system.
Reorganizing into that two-tiered hierarchy of core governance systems versus sectoral applications.
Exactly. We invite the author to apply these actionable insights, revise the material, and submit it back to us for another critique.
You know, shifting a national mindset from the accumulation of abstract wealth to the preservation of physical survival is arguably the most difficult structural engineering project a country can undertake.
It really is.
It requires an incredibly precise blueprint, but it also requires an unshakable connection to the physical realities on the ground.
Which leaves readers with a profound question. Once you realize the ground beneath you is moving, do you keep building your towers higher into the sky? Or do you finally learn how to secure the earth? Thanks for joining us today, everyone.